Good evening, everybody. This is Bonnie Kay, and this is the Straight Wives Talk Show. We're starting a moment or two earlier than usual, and are you there, Suzette?
I'm here.
The reason why we're starting a moment or two earlier is because I screwed up the timing on this, but that's okay. We're here now. But we'll just wait another 2 minutes while we're waiting, because in case people turn in at 10 o'clock and we're early, so maybe we can just play a song in the meantime. Is that okay?
Sounds wonderful, Don.
All right, let me start out with our theme song. Let's see if I can get that playing. One moment.
I can see clearly now.
The rain is gone.
Sing it, girl.
I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me down. Gonna be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. You know that part, Suzette.
I know it.
Bright, sunshiny day. I think I can make it now. The pain is gone.
The pain is gone.
The dark feelings have disappeared.
Disappeared.
The rainbow I've been waiting for. It's gonna be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. Look all around, there's nothing but blue skies. Look overhead, nothing but blue skies. Invigorates me every Sunday night that we're on this radio show. And welcome to all our listeners to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you do have any comments that you would like to make during this broadcast, you can either call them in at area code 646-716-4893, or if you are radio shy, you're welcome to email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E at AOL.com. Before I introduce my co-hostess, my friend, my mentor, my coach, my fabulous singer, beautiful friend, Suzette Hinton. That's all of you, Suzette. I do want to make the announcement that we do have, in 1 month from today, our upcoming healing retreat in California. And I am really excited to be going out there with our California women to get together and have a healing weekend with some wonderful women who will be returning and some new women who are just starting their journeys, who need support. And when you come to a healing weekend, when you leave there, you always feel totally refreshed, renewed, validated, and your thinking becomes very much, what I hate to coin this cliche, straightened out, But, you know, hearing stories from all the other women who have lived the path that you're riding is a really wonderful thing. And therefore, you know, whatever it takes to come there, you know, there's no cost for the conference itself. We have a discount rate at the hotel. You know, you pay for one meal and that's it. You know, the rest of it, you're on your own there. You can pay for your own meals. But we just ask you to pay for one meal that helps cover the cost of the conference rooms. But it will be a very memorable weekend. We're going to have speakers there and people who will help you on your journey, success stories. We'll have some informational speakers, including on, you know, sexually transmitted diseases and HIV. And also Janine Finelli, who's our health coach, she's going to be there giving out some wonderful tips. And her new book is coming out soon. We're going to be discussing that at the conference. So there's going to be a lot of activity going on. It's 10 minutes away from the LAX. There's a shuttle bus that takes you right to the hotel. If you are interested, please drop me a note at bondk@aol.com. You still have a couple weeks left to get the hotel rate, which is very reasonable for a beautiful hotel. And you'll be one of those California girls forever after you go there. So that was the announcement I wanted to make, and now I'm going to welcome you. Suzette, how are you?
I am great, Bonnie. It's wonderful to join you tonight.
And I really appreciate that. We're doing this, changing our schedule around a little bit because we're not going to be on the show next week for the holiday weekend. So I wanted to make sure I had a dose of Suzette in there for everybody, you know, before the holiday starts, because you're always so uplifting to people who listen. I get the best compliments about you.
So, oh, that is great.
I know. I'm very impressed that people are so impressed with you, but, you know, I am, so why shouldn't they be, I always say. But, you know, since we last talked last month, I do have a few things that happened to me. I was in a really bad car crash a few weeks ago. I know. It's really amazing that I'm alive, but I have some really great guardian angels looking out after me.
Oh,
and, I know, a man ran a stop sign, and he ran right into me. So it was quite a traumatic thing, having that airbag go off and all the smoke that was in the, you know, car, thinking you're going to be dying in a fire.
Oh,
because
I never had that
happen to me before, so I didn't know what it was going to be like. But I did survive. I walked away from it. You know, I had a couple of broken fingers and contusions and bang-ups and cuts and burns, but overall, I'm doing good. I'm keeping focused on getting to California. So,
man. Well, I'm so glad you're here, my friend.
Me too. Not everybody feels that way, but we do, and that's what really counts, right?
That's right. They don't have a voice. Their voice doesn't count.
Exactly. That's the way I feel about it, too. So that happened, and also, I'm going to be launching my own new book starting next week, in this upcoming week. I'm getting my website all set up for it. And this is a really personalized book. This is a story about my daughter and our relationship as she walked through the valley of death of drug addiction. And it's a very sad story, but it's really a book for parents or people who have relatives who are involved with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
To give them the support that they need, because so many of the same emotional impacts are the same. You know, when you have a child who dies from drugs if you have a child who's, you know, going through drug addiction, that you feel that same sense of shame and what did I do wrong or why wasn't I a good parent. There's a lot of very similar kinds of, you know, things with guilt, with, you know, I could have done a better job. And I think that parents who lose children to drugs will suffer through this, because I did run a support group for a while for this when my daughter died back in 2002. But, you know, it was too hard to keep running it. After a year, I gave it up because it was really difficult. So my daughter left a lot of writing behind. It's very shocking kind of writing, very upsetting. But people have to know, you know, I try to really kind of have this book for two purposes. One, to really give support to the parents who are going through this battle that just never, you can't win. And also to humanize the children who become drug addicts. You know,
yeah.
People are very fast to call them all kinds of names and knock them down, but they weren't always drug addicts. They weren't born drug addicts. They became drug addicts once they started taking drugs.
Right.
But I think through my daughter's writings, you know, they're very painful, but at least people can see what people go through during this kind of, you know, terrible part of their life. So
by writing, does it mean that she was keeping a diary?
Well, she would send me poems and letters, you know, about, you know, and they were very, you know, very depressing. I'm not going to tell you they were happy poems. Some of them were hopeful, you know, that she could lick it, you know, and beat the battle. But, you know, one of the things that I emphasize with the book is that when she first came to me, when she was not even 19 years old yet, she was still 18. And we'd been going through a tough time because I'd been trying to reach her for over a week. And, you know, she wasn't answering my phone calls. And we just were always in touch, you know, every day. And we would get together two or three times a week. She moved into an apartment down the street. And I was so angry, and her friends were covering for her, saying, oh, she was not feeling good, we'll take up the food to her, you know. But so I knew something was off. I just didn't know, never conceived what it could be. So when she finally said, Mom, I'm going to come talk to you after a week, you know, she said, I said, all right, well, come on over. And she told me that, you know, she had been really sick, and that's why she hadn't been in touch with me. And right away I thought, is something wrong? Did you, you know, have a car accident? You know, what could it be that you were so sick that you couldn't call me? And then she said to me, Mom, I have to tell you this. She says, I know you're going to be very upset, but I just spent the week withdrawing from heroin. And I was I was so stupid, you know, when she told me that. So I said to her, are you off the heroin now? Not that I even knew she was on the heroin to start with. But I said, are you, because this is how stupid I was, I said, are you off the heroin? She said, yes. I said, okay, well, good. She goes, no, Ma, it's not good. I said, well, what do you mean it's not good? You withdrew. And she said, Mom, you don't understand. Only 1 out of 100 people ever recover from heroin. And I said, 1 out of 100? She said, yes. I said, that's wonderful, Jennifer. And she looked at me like I'm really must not have heard her. She said, Mom, I don't think you heard me. I said, well, I said, I heard you. I said, that's wonderful news. She says, well, what's wonderful about it? I said, well, 1 out of 100 people recover, and you're going to be that one. You know, I really did believe that it wasn't hopeless. She's telling me 1 out of 100, so why shouldn't she be that one? Having no clue what this enemy was that I was up against, you know, with heroin. And, you know, once again, it was an endless stream of battles and roads and ups and downs. You know, she would do well for a while, then she'd fall down again. You know, a lot of it was due to her age, you know, that she wasn't old enough to get past it. But it was really interesting that when she passed away, after 3.5 years of, you know, selling her body on the street and doing all kinds of criminal acts, that I started this support group for parents who lost children to drugs after about, you know, maybe 9 or 10 months after she passed away. And it was interesting that the parents who were coming to my meetings, they were from all spectrums of life, but they were practically all professional people. They were nurses and teachers, and had a doctor coming, and all of them had lost their children to drugs as well, mental health workers, people who were in the human services field. And they didn't have any other kind of drug addiction problems in their families. These are like solo cases. And it was interesting one time when Jennifer went to rehab in Florida, she was a roommate of the police commissioner's daughter from here in Philadelphia.
Wow.
So, you know, the point I like to make to people is drugs crosses over all boundaries, all lines. You know, it doesn't just pick on certain people or certain nationalities or certain races. No, it crosses all lines. I say everybody is vulnerable.
Yeah, it doesn't discriminate.
No discrimination. And, you know, I think it's really an epidemic in our country now.
Yeah.
That it's hard to find families that haven't been touched by drugs, if not within their own children, their children's friends, their relatives. You know, it's really scary.
Very true.
So.
It's become an epidemic on TV, too. It's like, I don't know if there's ever been a time where it was just you heard so much, like so much about mental illness and excessive drug use in Hollywood and in the entertainment industry. And wow.
I know, it's so prevalent.
So prevalent. Okay.
And I also know that in the gay community, drugs are very, very prevalent also, much more so than in other kinds of communities, because these are people who are discriminated against and trying to escape who they are. And my daughter was a lesbian, but, you know, she certainly was out and about, you know, she was proud of who she was, and I, you know, pushed that into her, that there's no shame there. You were born as, you know, who you are. You don't have to feel ashamed about it. And I talk about her lesbianism in the book also. And, you know, why it's so important for children not to have that hanging over them, because you don't want that to be the reason that your child has to use drugs. That you have to learn to love your children in spite of whatever their sexuality is. They have no choice in that. It's not like they made a choice to be gay.
Yeah, there's
right?
So much shame and guilt, surrounding. Gays, and especially when they're young, and you know, even when you're young, you don't have the. Sometimes you don't have that. Not even sometimes. You don't have that life experience, that grounding that comes with as you become an adult.
Uh-huh.
And I can only imagine just how hard it is. How hard it is.
Well, I say for parents who lose children, any loss of any child is the most horrific thing that a parent can go through. And I know that because I lost my son, you know, a couple of years later from the disease he was born with. He was a fighter. You know, he was becoming a teacher at Westchester University, but he had over 30 hospitalizations. He had a very rare immune deficiency disease. So when I lost him, you know, I was totally broken for a long time because, you know, we were so closely bonded. And, you know, the loss of any child under any circumstances is painful, but when you have a child with drugs, it's like a double death. Because, first of all, you're going through the addiction with your child, and you feel so helpless. You think there is nothing you can do to beat this enemy. I thought, in the beginning, okay, I can beat this, you know, she's 18 years old, she's not that old, she'll get over this. You know, I had no clue what I was thinking. I mean, I just didn't have the understanding or the knowledge, and I just thought it was something you could beat. I didn't know how strong a pull it had on people. And, you know, you're going through that, you're watching your child fall down the drain, and I talk about, you know, in this story, when Jennifer graduated high school, she won a scholarship to college. And, you know, she said she wants to take a year off because she wants to go to work. And I was always empathizing with her because I was a late bloomer, and I thought, well, she's that way too, not having no concept of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And she went out to work, and she got an apartment with some of her friends. And it was a matter that, you know, her behavior was erratic, but I just didn't recognize it, that it was a drug problem. I think that's the problem. For a lot of parents also. You know, children are really good at hiding things, and, you know, people say you can't blame yourself. I don't blame myself, you know, for not recognizing it any more than our women don't recognize their husbands for not being gay. You know,
right.
Just like gay husbands lie really well because they're living a lie every day. You know, children using drugs lie really well, too, because they know how to hide it. And I think if we look back to when we were teenagers, there were things that all of us did that our parents never knew about, right?
Well, that's true. That's true.
Even though you were a good church girl, didn't you do some things wrong?
Yeah, that's what the well came from. It was like, so many things I didn't experience so much later because I was afraid of the wrath of my parents.
Didn't do anything wrong?
Oh, I was a closet wrongdoer.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I went mom and dad left the house, and I think the biggest wrongdoing that I did was dancing to what my dad called Ookie Doot music. I'd turn on the radio and listen to the Supremes, and I'd dance, because back then in our
church dancing was a sin, so I would wait till they were gone and I'd turn on the radio and I'd dance. Or I'd go in the bathroom and cuss out loud when they were gone. And my baby sister, God bless her heart, she was just like, oh, God, please don't strike my sister for this erratic, rebellious behavior. And that was about the most I did, a kiss a boy in the car.
That was terrible.
I'm telling you, you would have thought I had, you know, met with him and his whole family.
How old were you then?
Oh, man. I was, I think I was a sophomore in high school because I was dating a senior. And we had gone to the prom. And we were in the car necking. I hear an echo. Do you hear an echo, Bonnie?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. I was in the car, and our neighbors must have seen me in the car kissing. And what was so interesting is it was all innocent kissing. I mean, no reaching under clothes, no touching, no feeling, no groping, just everything lip to lip.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was furious with me. She told me I had to make a decision whether I was going to serve God or I was going to engage in that kind of sinful behavior.
Was it a hard decision to make?
Well, you know, when she put that to me, that I was going to serve God, you know, I was like, okay, I had to stop and serve God.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Did you make up for it later on a little bit, maybe?
Oh, girl, I went a little bit crazy.
Okay, good. I feel better now. You see, because while you were being so good, I was really being bad. I was always being self-destructive. You know, I think it came from my lack of self-esteem. You know, I was always doing things that were self-destructive. And I think this is why I really, you know, my daughter, I missed the signs, and I was always feeling sorry for her because, you know, I knew she had a weight problem like I had. And, you know, she had some single family, parent family she came up in, and she had a lot of anger issues. And, you know, she had a part of her was so good, but the other part was not. And it was just, you know, I think she was very tortured. But the whole situation, as I started telling you, when you have a child who's doing drugs and you find out and then you know and you're trying to, you know, fix the problem constantly, running from program to program, meeting to meeting, and just feeling like no matter what you're doing, you're back to where you start like every couple months. It's like go back to jail, you know, because the addiction starts all over again. So, you know, you're dying constantly. So you're dying like a double death with kids with drugs. And my heart goes out to parents whose kids haven't died, but they're on that road to destruction. You know, and you feel like a train is going to run you over and you can't get away fast enough. And, you know, it's very difficult. So I'm hoping this book will be a big help to people. I'll be announcing it in the upcoming week, and they'll send out notices to people, and we'll talk about it, you know, next month when you come back.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening new in my life. So what's happening new in your life?
Well, I almost feel ashamed to say anything. I can't top that, Bonnie. Oh, my God. I'm just continuing to plan the wedding. Yay.
Coming now you're excited
up.
About that, right?
Oh, my gosh. I am. But you know what I'm most excited about? I'm most excited about my relationship with my fiance. It's like, most people are focused on, you can't wait till we get married, but it's like we're enjoying every moment we spend leading up to it.
So how is he feeling? Is he getting nervous too?
No, he's not nervous. He said he's not nervous at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not either. I think we're just so excited. It's like we kind of look at each other with these little silly grins on our faces, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's wonderful. You know, I think what's wonderful about it and why I'm so happy about it is because I try to explain to people that no matter how bad your lives are right now, that there is hope for after marriage. And I'm always trying to put those stories in my newsletter, and you're living proof, well, living proof, that, you know, you can find the person who have true love with and that life can go on, right?
Oh, indeed, indeed. Better than your fantasy. I thought I had a really rich imagination about my Prince Charming, but I'm telling you, this man has completely made my reality better than any dream I could have had. And the beautiful thing is, it's not a pretense, because you know that they say, you know, that a person, how a person really is the person that their family tells you, the family really, really knows. And I haven't heard not anything derogatory about his sincere heart and his giving, loving spirit.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's a wonderful thing, and I am so excited because I experienced that loving energy and that unselfish, kind genuineness every time I listen. Every time.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, I'm telling you, buddy, I could just scream. It's so good.
I know. And you know what? Did you think this would happen when your marriage ended?
Honey, not even. I couldn't even think this far. I was so busy just trying to escape. I couldn't even conceive this because I had never known it. I had never known this kind of love of a man. So I had no point of reference. The only thing I had was watching The Wonderful World of Disney when I was a child, or watching soap operas like The Guiding Light and, you know, the Edge of Night and Bob and Lisa on As the World Turns. I watched a lot of that and formed a lot of opinions of that was what love was, because my parents were not affectionate, so I didn't see healthy love in the family. My parents loved each other very much so and stayed married for over 40-something years, but I saw the rigors and the ups and the downs and the difficulties of their love journey. I didn't get to see them when they finally got to that point of peace with each other. That was when I moved away from home. So I didn't have the benefit of seeing that.
What kind of marriage do you think they had, if you had to look at it objectively now?
Oh, my. Very, very troubled, grounded in fantasy thinking, not true reality. A whole lot of religious talk and a lot of God talk, but not a whole lot of reality. My mom confessed to being very ignorant. And my dad was very worldly. And she would often tell us that he tricked her. She was gullible. And he tricked her by pretending like he had had a God experience, you know, so that he could be the quote-unquote saved man that she needed him to be, because she wasn't going to marry him unless he was. And so he played the role to get her. So their marriage was very, very difficult because she felt deceived. She was disappointed. He felt, you know, in a lot of ways trapped because she didn't want to do the things that he wanted to do. So it was a marriage of obligation. I think my dad truly loved my mom, but I think from my mom's standpoint, you know, I think there was some subconscious resentments there. because of him not being who she thought he was, and her own mistrust of men. You know, it was a perpetual, thing. The dysfunction was perpetual. So I think they were doing the best they could to pretend to be adults, but didn't really know how to, love, didn't know what it looked like, didn't know what it felt like.
And divorce wasn't a consideration back then, right?
Well, my mom said that there was a point where she was tempted to leave. She said she had packed her bags up when I was a little girl. She had packed her bags up and she was getting ready to leave him, and she said that God stopped her at the door and said, no. No, not, don't do this. No. And she stayed married to him, and remarkably, before he died, they had a wonderful relationship. She said he was the husband she had always dreamed of.
What about that?
Yeah.
But it took all those years until that happened, right?
Oh, my God. They went through hell. We all did.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was hell in our house. For it to be a Christian home, it was hell in our house.
And there probably was
all
that in a lot of homes. I would suspect a lot of... I think a lot of homes might have been that same way.
Yeah. And nobody talked about it because it was this thing of, you know, what happens in this house stays in this house.
Exactly.
So you didn't feel that liberty to talk, to even get help. I felt so trapped and so suffocated. Oh,
terrible.
My God. Oh, my God.
That's why I'm a very big advocate of divorce. You know, I came from divorced parents. And my sisters were much younger than I was. You know, they grew up pretty much with a single parent home. I grew up in a house of little house of horrors with parents who were constantly at each other's throat, constantly outdoing one another with bad things, you know, to outdo the other one. And, you know, we were all caught in the middle there.
Yeah.
But my sisters, when my parents split up, they were little. They were like 1, 3, and 5. So even though they didn't have financially the benefits, they were far more secure growing up without all that fighting going on.
Yeah.
So I really do believe that when you have a marriage that's broken, you know, that can't be fixed, you have to move on and just let it go.
Yeah. And it didn't help because even you were talking about your daughter's drug addiction. My father's addiction of choice was alcohol, and he was a functional alcoholic, but he was given to a lot of binges. You know, he would binge, go into a drinking thing, you know, that would last several weeks. Then he would have an attack of consciousness, and he'd stop and be very, very contrite, very apologetic, and would tell us he was going to get it together, he was going to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would invariably go to church, and I cannot count how many times he would come down that aisle crying, giving the preacher his hand and God his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would be very legalistic and rigid and puritanistic. The God police, it's an awful thing living with the God police, I'm telling you. And so it was like he was like the God police on steroids. So we could not do anything right. We could not say anything right. It was just very tough to live in that type of environment. And it continued to be that way until I graduated and went to college. And it was always an up and down roller coaster ride for 18 years, a roller coaster ride of watching my daddy's revolving door, Christianity.
Uh-huh.
You know, Christianity, binge drinking. And I remember many times I would ask God to please let him just be in between. I loved him most when he was contrite, when he was neither a Christian, you know, saved, or drinking. I liked him when he was in that in-between stage. So that was the only time he was actually vulnerable and touchable and caring and affectionate and That was the only time, but it never lasted.
Uh-huh.
It never lasted. And that was, so I kept being disappointed over and over and over again. So, you know, just like you were saying when we talked about my marrying a gay man twice, you were saying, you know, if I'd grown up that way, it's like, it would, that's the natural thing to happen to you for the way you grew up. I understand how it happened. And that
mm-hmm.
was so freeing for me to hear you say, I get it. I understand how it happened. And I had never thought of it that way. But then when I look back, I'm like, yeah, why not me? It was like, why
right.
me? What if you're a gay man? But it's like, I was destined for it. I was set up for it.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, when so many women go through these feelings of guilt and they shouldn't do it, should they get divorced? I always say, get divorced. If you have to question, should I, that means you're already not there.
Mm.
And if your marriage is in bad shape like yours was or mine was, no woman should have to live with any kind of abuse in her marriage, whether it's emotional or physical and, you know, sexual for sure, because you and I both know there's sexual abuse by not having sex with your wife. You know, that's sexual abuse, wouldn't you say so?
Oh, my God. Shall I ascend to my soapbox? It
yeah,
is. It is. And the thing that gets me, especially when I'm coaching clients that are dealing with, are either living with gay husbands or whatever, they don't know whether he's gay or not yet. One of the hardest things is to get them to realize that it is sexual abuse, but it isn't just sexual abuse. Because they're like, but he's really nice to me. I'm like, no, it's like somebody's, like you're sitting at a table, and this person is smiling at you, but kicking you under the table.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I don't care if they're nice. They're still withholding from you. That is not love. That is not kindness. That is not respect. So on top of not having sex, they are disregarding your whole gender. You can never be different. You can never be anything but become a better woman. And by virtue of you being a better woman, you are rejected. It's like that's abuse across the board. That's social
uh-huh.
abuse. That's spiritual abuse. That's all of it. It's like all of it in some way, shape, or form, it is abuse. It's denial of your person. It is denial of your value and your worth as a woman worthy of love. They're willing to keep you barefoot and ignorant.
So I'd like to read you this letter that came to me yesterday, and I'm not going to expose who the person is, you know, certainly I'm keeping that confidential, but
okay.
I want to give you like an idea of where some of these men's thinking and where their heads are at. So, let me check that. This is one. Some of these letters are just a little worse than others.
Okay, I'm just going to breathe deeply while you read.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find this one here. I don't want to misquote in any way. All right. It says, I am a happy gay man and in a healthy relationship with another gay man. I have had short affairs with women in my student years that did not last long before I came out of the closet. I always knew that I was only attracted to men, but it is a very hard psychological struggle to admit it. Also, being gay in the vast majority of the world is not seen as being okay. A big part of the world sees homosexuals as being wrong, perverts, etc. This is even still the case in our modern Western world. There are quite a lot of closeted gay people who kill themselves because they cannot live with themselves as society labels them as being wrong. I grew up in another country, and I still found it hard to come out of the closet. When reading your introduction page made me a bit angry. I can understand it's hard for women to live with a closeted man, and helping them is good. But the way you bring it, in my opinion, is as a closeted gay man, we are broken or dysfunctional men who are treating their female partners very wrong and should know better and should never have gotten married. To me, you are labeling them as bad guys and the women are the victims. This is way too black and white for me. It is hard for both, in my opinion. Looking at my own experience, there can be a lot of love without physical intimacy. Also, a lot of straight couples have no sex in their relationship. It is not a gay man, straight women problem only. Gay men that have been married to women often become best friends with their exes after the breakup. What I am going to say is, please also show empathy for the closeted gay man. I think it's best to help both. Gay men usually stay in the closet because they are very afraid, not because they are bullies. You may probably agree, and it is not your intention to give this impression, but reading your website triggered me with this reaction. So, you know, I don't like to argue in these cases, but I do like people to... Huh?
I'm breathing, girl.
But here's the whole thing. I wrote back to him, you know, you wrote to me that you're with your partner. Would it be okay if your partner didn't want to have sex with you? You know, is that okay for you? You know, because I don't think it would be. But I think what these guys miss is that even as couples grow older and maybe they're not having sex anymore, things happen. But they've had a history of it. They know what intimacy is. They've been with each other. You know, they've had each other. And that's not to say that sex has to go on forever.
Yeah.
Except in my house, it does. But the point is that, you know, sometimes people, for whatever reasons, they want to give up that part of their life. But they've already had a good life behind it. I think it's a little wrong to think that people can be best of friends, first of all, after these marriages. And that just because a lot of straight couples have no sex, this is how these men look at it. I mean, it's really mixed up in their heads, I believe. So what do you think of this?
Oh, goodness. My thing is this. You can live in the closet as much as you want to, as long as you don't have me in there with you. If you have me locked in the closet with you, then yes, I'm going to object to it. And yes, it is wrong of you to manipulate me, to lie to me, to mislead me, to play with my mind, to play with my emotions, to keep me in your damn closet. So, you know, and I loved your point you made. If you are a happy gay man, that means you're getting some.
Right. How happy would he be not to have any relationship with his partner and say, well, there's a lot more to a relationship than sex?
That's only when it pertains to a woman. If you are happy with your partner, you are either getting some, or like we were saying, the difference with being with a straight man versus a gay man is the prevailing energy of affection and acceptance. And that sexual energy that's happening around you, even when you're not having intercourse. There's a sexual dance that happens when you're with somebody who's in love with you, even if you are not engaging, technically, in intercourse, you're still making love.
Right.
Anyway. So
look,
my thing is,
when I lay down with my boyfriend, we don't have to be having hardcore sex, but I mean, he touches
exactly.
me, he feels me, you know, he loves to cuddle with me and touch my body parts.
Exactly.
You know, it doesn't have to be time, but that's what they want. I mean, that's what straight men want, sex.
And my thing is, if he's in a happy relationship, then he is getting that from his partner. Even if they're not engaging in, you know, heart throbbing, pulsating, colliding loins every single night, there is still that sexual dance that couples in love do. And when you're with somebody who does not want you in that way, there is no dance.
Uh-huh.
There is no residual warm, fuzzy, moist when you're around each other. And I understand in any relationship, you've got your routine day-to-day things. You have the kids. You have this. You have that and a third. But if you say you are happy, there's got to be some sense of intimacy and connection in that relationship if you're happy in it. So
uh-huh.
My thing is, don't deprive me. Don't make it so that you can have it as a happy gay man. You can have it with your lover. But now, if you're married to me, I shouldn't complain because you want to give me all these reasons why it shouldn't be that way. Hypocrite. Because if the shoe was on the other foot, you would not like it. And you would be objecting.
Right.
So that's why I'm like, you know what? Cry me a river. And it doesn't mean that I don't care. I understand from an empathetic standpoint, I understand what it's like to live a fictitious life and feel like you have no other choice but to do so. I understand that. But what I don't understand is your determination to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand that. I understand having gone through it. But as we mature and we become more in alignment with ourselves and with our feelings and as we grow and all that, then I cannot understand the determination to stay there. And to hold hostages, to turn this into a hostage situation where the person that's in the closet with you are being held hostage emotionally.
Isn't that the truth?
Emotionally.
Exactly.
You are holding your wife and your children and your family hostage to your own life, and you want us to feel empathy and sorry for you? I'm sorry. I understand humanity. I understand it, and I'd be a hypocrite if I did not say I understand to be human. I get that. But you still have to look at it from the standpoint, this woman is in a hostage situation. And that is so
unfair. And that's so beautifully said.
That is so unfair. Now, see, it's funny, talking to you, I was sitting down at first, and I had to curtsy, stand up and start walking.
Well, because you know what? I think these guys just don't get it. You know, I think that a gay man just doesn't understand this. And, you know, first of all, a lot of gay husbands, after they've stayed with you for a lot of years and they've sexually neglected you, emotionally neglected you, not bonded with your kids, you know, they're there because they have to be there. But, you know, they become really abusive because they're not where they want to be. They're frustrated, and they think they're doing you some big-time favor by being there when they could be leading their, you know, happy life if you weren't there keeping them in prison.
Yeah.
So that's where a lot of the resentment comes in. You know, they feel you're the jailer. You're the, you know, person holding the key to their happiness. And no matter what you do...
I think part of that is it's almost like if you have a conscience at all, it's easier to cheat on somebody that you can vilify as opposed to cheating on somebody who's understanding and loving and kind and all that. So it's almost
like...
You know,
that's so true. I never thought of that before.
And I think it's a slow road. I think in order for them to justify what they're doing, they have to somehow or another vilify you. So that means they've got to provoke you to
who's screaming, provoked.
Exactly.
Like anything they, you know, that you get provoked to all this because of the love that's being withheld from you, and then they blame you for it.
And I see that all the time. I see men who antagonize women in their marriages, and the women do get upset, and deservingly so. I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm saying I did, too, when I was in that situation. But that way, it does make it easier for them to say, well, she's a bitch.
Exactly. Exactly.
And who wants,
this,
you know,
terrible woman
this...
that I'm married to.
And then they shouldn't
yep.
blame you for having these feelings. Because if you had been a better wife and you were more supportive and you were doing everything right, well, what can I tell you? They wouldn't know how to become gay. You know, so this
oh,
is like
right.
in their distorted thinking, how they're able to justify their misactions.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it's wrong. And bless that fella's heart and all the rest of them who are choosing, you know, who may choose to have prior to coming out, had their wives and or their children in this situation. But I'm sorry, I have to totally agree with you, Vernon. You can't put a Band-Aid on this. You cannot put a Band-Aid on this no more than you could if it was a broken leg or the person had been in a car accident. That you can't put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. You can't do that. And I think a lot of times because it's emotional, because it's not something that a person can physically see, it gets minimized. But emotionally, these women are walking around with their hearts and their organs in a very alarming place. They're wounded, and a Band-Aid will not do. That's why they're taking antidepressants. That's why they're drinking. That's why some of them are having affairs. That's why a lot of them are dealing with depression. It's because it's at a chronic level, emotionally, just as it would be if a person needed surgery physically. It's just as emergent. It's just as important.
Mhm. I think you made some really excellent points with that. And I think that for women to keep staying in these marriages, you know, they have to. I know it's really hard to leave. And I know that you had a hard time, right?
Yeah, I think most of mine. The second time around was because I felt like an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like an absolute fool, so I really didn't want to face it because it was harder for me to deal with the guilt of knowing I had brought my son back into the situation again only to leave his father again.
Mm-hmm.
And to subject him to having to be deal with twice divorced.
After you got married the second time, how long did you stay with him?
About the same time. When I got close to the five-year mark, that was my awakening.
Mm-hmm.
4.5 to 5 years, I always seemed to be that awakening moment.
Mm-hmm.
When denial, rationalization, everything that you might have told yourself, it no longer worked. It was no longer enough. And you just said, you know, I can't deny this any longer. I can't put up with this any longer. This is not working for me. And so
did he try to manipulate you when you were getting out of it?
Yeah, he did, but in a whole different way. The first time when I left, I was the major breadwinner. He had a job with a hotel that was seasonal. And so I had the consistent corporate job.
Mm-hmm.
Second time around, it was his company. So my whole economy was tied into him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a whole different vibe because he felt like he was in power. So it was
Did you feel that way, too? Did you feel that way also?
It was awful. I didn't have my own car. I didn't have my own money. It was awful. I felt so trapped.
Mm-hmm.
I felt so trapped. I did not see a way out. I did not see a way out. And I was just like, God, if you will please help me. If you will please help me to get out of here this time, I promise you, I will not marry him again. I promise you, I will not do. And I ask you, I'm going to have my eyes wide open. Show me everything. I prayed it. I said, God, show me everything so I will not be gullible. I will not be ignorant. I won't be a sitting duck for a person that's gay ever again the rest of my life.
Uh-huh.
And I'm telling you, you sometimes have to be careful what you pray for. Because I found out things that I thought I was ready for, but Bonnie, I was not ready for.
Uh-huh.
It was so shocking, and it only added more insult to me as his wife for how long I stayed. The truth of what was going on behind my back.
Uh-huh.
And many times in my face, but I just was too ignorant to see it. It only added insult to injury. My pride took a big beat.
Did other people tell you about it?
Some of them waited till I was at a point of being ready to leave.
Uh-huh.
And then others, it was much later after I had left. They were like, well, gee, everybody knew he was gay. What was going on? We just thought you knew too,
and you were staying, right?
Yeah, they said him being with you made us question. But our first thought was he was gay. He doesn't come across gay. They were like, yes, he does. The only thing that made it confusing was that he was married to you.
Uh-huh.
Because you seemed like such a together sister. You had a good head on your shoulder. You were smart. You were a great mother. You carried yourself well. You were attractive. So it made it very difficult for us to put the two and two together. You seemed happy. Y'all seemed like you had a great relationship. So it was puzzling. It was very puzzling to us. Because of that. But our first, you know, they said first impression is 11. They said our first impression was he was gay.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, well, I'll be doggone. I didn't know that was the first impression. But
that's really strange, right? Now, did you have that impression? Did you have that impression at all?
That he was, well, you know, I was ignorant because, I mean, I don't want to label all the guys in the church at that time, in my church, but I'll put it this way, a lot of them were musical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them had a kind of musicality to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how to judge the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to judge the difference.
Well, it was a hard lesson to learn, right?
It was. You know what? I can say this on this side of it. I think what has healed me of the regret is because I realized that all of it worked together to bring me to this place. All of it, all the good, the bad, the up, the down, have brought me to this place of strength and clarity and wisdom. And
so what are you saying, Suzette? No pain, no gain?
Well, no, not so much no pain, no gain, but I have
no, I'm only kidding
there's
you.
A purpose that came out of it. my purpose.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that women...
The purpose arose.
You know what? I think having a bad relationship sometimes shows you the road to what a good relationship should look like.
Yeah.
I really do. you know, I think that as long as you can recognize that it's time to get out, you know, when you've had your time in there, that you don't want to spend another day wasted, you know, and you have to first be emotionally free before you can be physically free. So
very much.
It's a process, but all you have to do is write to us, write to me at bondk@aol.com. You know, Suzette's books will really give you the inspiration you need. You can get them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Tell them the titles of your book.
The titles are The Sound of My Life, The Sound of My Soul, and Protecting Your Emotional G-Spot.
And that book is a book every woman needs to read as required reading, because it will teach you what you how to think with intuition, how to think with your head, not with your heart, and how so many of our difficulties begin because we really aren't thinking the way we need to think. You know,
true.
We don't pay attention to what our intuition is telling us. You know, we're fighting it. We're debating it, right?
That's right. And many of us don't even know how to recognize it. We only recognize it hindsight.
Uh-huh.
But it's time for us to have, instead of our hindsight being 2020, it's time for our foresight to be 2020. And I wrote the book with that in mind.
Exactly. So you can get this on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can, you know, go to the link on my page for Suzette. Or you can go to her website, but they'll never remember it. So just go to Bond K, and you can go to my links, and you'll see Suzette there. So, Suzette, I want to thank you. We have 60 seconds left. I hope you have a wonderful holiday weekend next weekend. And thanks. I probably won't talk to you again until the 1st of, you know, October, because we're going to have a shortened month with my being away for their, you know, recruitment or for our healing weekend.
Yes.
I know, I'm so excited. But it will be another 4 weeks or 5 weeks. You'll be back. So you have a wonderful month. And you know I love you.
Oh, I love you back, girl.
All right. And everybody have a wonderful week. And we'll be back again very soon with Straight Wives Talk Show. Good night. And good night, Eva.
Good night.
Love you, Suzette. Bye-bye.
Love you, too. Bye-bye.